We're good to go.
Oh, except we lost Saki.
Oh, oh no. Let's just like Batman.
Where'd he go? You know, yeah, he turned around and he was gone.
I hate when he does that.
Yeah, exactly.
In 1975, Jaws was released. It is routinely regarded as one of the greatest films of all time and is generally credited with creating the concept of the summer blockbuster. In 1978, in an obvious cash grab, Jaws 2 was released, failing to have lightning strike a second time, but presenting a generally enjoyable film. In 1983, Jaws 3D was released, shamelessly attempting to take advantage of a gullible audience. By 1987, there was no pretense of quality as Lorraine Gary and Michael Caine cashed paychecks for sleepwalking through a pointless and incredulous sequel. In 2016, Paul Spitero created Is It Jaws, in which he and a group of rotating guest hosts discuss new and old movies and place them up against the Jaws scale, which ignores some elements of the actual films and sets forth a rating scale. Jaws, an all-time great classic film. Jaws 2, an enjoyable film with some flaws but worthy of multiple viewings. Jaws 3, a moderately enjoyable film. And finally, Jaws 4, a bad movie. Please join Paul and his guests as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Chucky saw.
You ain't a bat. Who are you? What do you want?
Your angel of death awaits.
It's vigilantism at its deadliest. How many times are we gonna let Batman cross the line?
He didn't do it. Batman does not kill, period. You want him, you get him.
Time to pay for your sins, Mr. Brunsky.
No! You're gonna pay one way or another.
No, please.
Give me one more day, I swear I'll get the money.
This time tomorrow, we'll have the money, or I'll have your heart.
Pack a suitcase. We've got to get to the airport now.
Your father, he was the one element that tied these gangsters together.
Daddy doesn't matter anymore.
Alpha 3 to ground, we have him!
Is it true? Is the Batman hitting our people?
Wrong!
I've seen the guy. It ain't the Bat.
This isn't a joke. How long till he gets you?
To find out who's iced the old gang.
Don't wait up.
Stay away. This is not your fight.
You! There are 20 miles of tunnels under this place, and they're all filled with high explosives.
This madness ends now.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and as always, in the metaphorical seat next to me is Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here today.
It is always a pleasure to do this show with you and with our other friends, and today we have what we were just discussing has become our Batman panel for reasons that I'm not even exactly sure why we've landed on Batman as our topic, but we've been going through the Batman catalog and we have finished with the Burtonverse. And before we get on to Batman Begins, we decided to stop on two animated features. And today we're doing the first of those, which is Batman Mask of the Phantasm. So our Batman panel consists of Brian Hall.
Hello.
Hello. And Mr. Zaki Hassan.
Good day.
Good day, sir. All right, and that's our show. So everybody, yeah.
Go watch Batman.
The Brian and Zachy signal has flashed into the sky. We have to go.
That's right.
I'm wondering what the Brian and Zachy signal would look like now.
Me too.
I'm thinking like a movie reel, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that. Yeah,
that would work.
So, Batman: Mask of the Phantasm. This one, I have a kind of an interesting history with this one because I remember when this came out in 1993, I was still single, so I was a happy guy. I mean, I was still single, and I didn't have any children. And I remember my brother, whose son at the time was probably 3 or 4, saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to take Thomas to see this new Batman cartoon in the movies. And I was just like taken aback a little bit that this was a theatrical release. Like that caught me off guard right off the bat. And I didn't see it for a while. I think I saw it when my son was old enough, so probably about 10 years after this. And I had bought him the DVD of it, and I think we sat down and watched it together. And I think that was my first viewing of it. And I've always enjoyed it. But I really haven't seen it as much as my memory made me think I've seen it. I think this is only the second time I've seen it like from beginning to end.
Oh, wow.
Nonstop. I've seen bits and pieces of it over the years. But I think it's only, the second time I've seen it, you know, from beginning to end. And for years and years and years, I've been hearing this is the most faithful, the best Batman movie there is. And I think that's going to be the subject of our discussion, because I don't think it's a question of, is this a good movie? I think it's going to be a question of, is this a good movie? Is this a really good movie? Is this a great movie? I think that's going to be the discussion. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you guys are going to tell me, no, this sucked. But why don't we go around and get some initial thoughts? Sean?
So when this 93 came out, I was already a big fan of Batman. Batman's my guy, by the way. I'm a huge Batman fan. If you were to say, who's your number one superhero since childhood, it was Batman. Batman and Spider-Man were sort of tied, but the Bat always won out. I grew up a child of Batman 66 and Spider-Man's animated series. And I'm talking about the Spider-Man. I mean, that was my childhood. So, that was the guy stuck with me all the way through in various renditions. Batman the Animated Series came out, I was captivated. I was like, wow, this was, you know, we're still on the kind of the love that we got from Batman 89, and where it was like, wow, we're kind of taking Batman in a different direction as far as media goes. And now we've got an animated series that is edgy and telling really good long-form storytelling. This was an interesting one because I remember when it came out in the theater, I went opening night like I would for something like this. I was really interested, but this one kind of came out in a weird whimper. Like it wasn't a lot of noise behind it like there was the Michael Keaton animated movie. I loved it. I remember back at the day loving it, but similar to kind of what's been said here, just in the initial opening comments, I watched Batman the Animated Series back, and there's episodes like Christmas with the Joker and stuff like that that I've seen many, many, many times. This one, I think because I start doing a rewatch of the animated series, I tend to, it's not that I skip it, I just don't get to it as frequently. When we said we were going to do it for this, I was super excited because I'm like, I remember really loving that. But I haven't seen it in a while, which is so bizarre. So I watched it for this, and I've got to say, I remembered certain things before I even viewed it. But so much of this felt fresh to me because it had been a while since I've touched it. And it's going to be very interesting to talk about this film today, as opposed to when I saw it originally when it came out. I've seen it multiple times, but there's been gaps, really big gaps, that have been kind of inexplicable, considering the fact that I love this character as much as I do.
Brian, what do you say?
You know, kind of similar to what both of you said, this is probably only the second time I've seen it all the way through. And this, I can tie this story back to Zachy. Well, let me go back a little bit further. Batman's always been my guy too. And just with my experience, it was less with the comics, but with TV, the syndicated Batman 66 was, this is Batman. And I'm like, well, I love this. I love all the villains. I love Batman. I love Robin. I love the Batmobile. And then of course, Tim Burton's Batman 89 comes out, and I'm like, oh, like now Batman is my thing. Like, it just captivated me in such a way. And the animated series was so amazing because I think it came out around Batman Returns.
Yeah.
And what I loved about it was it had elements of the darkness and gothic sort of feeling. Elfman did the opening credits, music and everything, but it also was a kind of its own thing as well, leaned into sort of the 1930s comic booky gangster sort of feel. And I loved all the, it broadened Batman for me. And so when this came out, however, I just kind of missed it. Sort of like what Sean said. I mean, I'm not sure I even remember it coming out, but I do remember Zachy telling me I should watch it, loaning me the video. And it was one of those things where it just sat on my shelf. And I remember having feelings of looking at that thing, knowing that it was well regarded, knowing that Zachy wanted me to watch it. And somehow I never got back to it. And I might have either I didn't return it or I did return it. I don't know. But I saw it for the first time. I looked it up because I keep track of every movie I watch. So before Letterboxd, I have a Word document that I've been writing everything I watch. First time I saw it was 2019.
Oh, wow.
And so there was a lot that it had to live up to in my mind because I've heard people say this is one of the, if not the best Batman movies. So I was like, how can that possibly be? This thing's under 90 minutes. It's like an hour and 15 minutes soaking wet. And it's incredible. I was like, oh, I get it. I mean, just this, what I love about it is you get all the spectacle and you get all the razzle dazzle in all the live action films. And in this one, we can talk about the animation, which is beautiful / a little janky, but the script is so good. It's so much about the interiority of Bruce Wayne in a way that I don't feel like I've seen, like a romantic angle, a real exploration of of what is romance to Bruce Wayne and what would that have meant to his mission? And could that have, gotten him to be like, you know what, maybe I've done enough. Maybe I could have this. Just the choices that were presented to him. It's just things I felt like I hadn't seen explored before. And I really loved it and really resonated with it. And so I was very happy to come back to it again last night and be reminded like, oh yeah, this is as great as I remember. So.
All right. Zachy, what do you say?
So I did not see this when it first came out in theaters. I definitely remember, because it was Christmas of 93, so it was in the middle of my freshman year, and obviously I was busy with just high school stuff, but also it was like, I've watched every episode of the TV show. I can get it at home. I don't need to go to the theater to see it. And clearly a lot of other people had that same idea, because Mark Hamill has told the story of watching it opening night in an empty theater. And so I rented it sometime. It was before Batman Forever came out, for sure. I was like, oh, this is great. This is the same stuff that the TV show has been doing. And it was like an exercised episode of the show for me. Since then I've seen it I think at least once for like every batch of my kids. My earlier my two older ones when they were between 8 and 10, and then my next few, and I've got a few of these people in my house, so by virtue of that I've ended up watching it a fair amount. And I think before this viewing for our conversation, I think the last time I saw it was for a commentary track I recorded with John Trumbull on the Nostalgia Theater Show. And talk about a great way to experience this movie is with a sort of a expert on the DC animated universe, But what I remember most is Siskel and Ebert reviewing it on their show after Batman Forever came out. So, it had been on home video for a while and they were apologetic. They're like, we don't know how we missed this. Mm-hmm. It is so good. And they were contrasting it with the movie in theaters at the moment, which is Batman Forever. So, that tells you something about how much this achieved what the filmmakers tried to, even if nobody turned up in theaters to watch it.
See, what I was kind of hoping was that you were going to say, I saw it, I was enamored with it, I saved and saved and saved and bought the DVD, and I gave it to Brian, and I've been cursing him ever since because I don't have it anymore.
That's why I'm here. Where's my DVD?
I'm pretty sure the DVD I gave you was like a two-pack or a double feature. It was this and also the Mr. Freeze one, the Sub-Zero. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know where Zachy's went. I was a part of the tape train. It came for Brian over. Yeah. I passed it on. It was because that was back in the day of tape trains.
that's hilarious.
See, isn't that great, Zachy? You give and you give.
You brought
joy. I've been wondering. It's great to have that answered.
So, as I often do, when I watched this the other day to kind of prepare for today, I put on the Is It Yours Facebook page that I was watching this. And it got some comments, and I thought it was worth exploring them for a moment. Mm-hmm. So it was on the Is It Yours page, which is explains the first comment, which it just said, yes, no question about it. Mm-hmm. So then that was Aaron Henley. Then Chris Franklin said the greatest Batman film. J. David Weider said recently got to see this in the theater once again, still holds up. Mm-hmm. But the most interesting comment, I thought, came from Trentus Magnus, who said, not as good as its reputation would suggest, always had quibbles with this film. And Douglas Meacham said, please explain. So Trentus went on. He said, it is a great origin revenge film. My gripe with it has always been that young Bruce was well on his way to not becoming Batman in the movie. And it's only because Andrea blew town unexpectedly that he decided to become Batman. I just don't like the idea, never have. If you think of Batman as Bruce's curse or whatever, then becoming Batman is pretty much his unavoidable destiny. The night his parents were murdered, nothing will stop that from happening now, or at least nothing should stop that from happening. But in Mask of the Phantasm meeting, Andrea nearly derailed what should have been Bruce's unalterable destiny. It's not that big of a deal, but this aspect of Mask of the Phantasm has always bothered me a little. And I, you know, that got me thinking, which I hadn't really thought about that perspective on it, because the scene, I think it's probably the most powerful scene in the movie when he's at his parents' grave saying, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't think I could be happy, but I am, mm-hmm. you know, do I need to do this? I can donate money to the police. I can serve this purpose. So, like, I think that's the most powerful thing. And I do think it's true to Batman's character that he would always want this not to be his destiny because it's hard. It's a major burden. But on the other hand, I think he always accepted it as being his destiny. So I don't know how much he fought against it, even though it was a burden. So it's, like I said, it's got me thinking about all of that and thinking how does that all play? And is it true to his character? Because originally I thought it's extremely true to his character. And now I'm saying, is it?
I have an answer to that. And it's something that I really like about this film because it was, and I've never felt this before, this particular viewing of this film. One of the things I love about DC is they introduced this concept of Elseworlds. And Elseworlds being this concept, and really Batman is the epitome of Elseworlds because a majority of Elseworlds is Batman. They've explored other characters as time has gone on, but certainly its foundation's deep-rooted in Batman. Both large and small conceptual changes to Batman's world to show what if these type of things happened. Batman the Animated Series is an example of, in my mind, an example of, and this is totally my mind, you guys can poke it apart, please. But in my mind, what I've found that I've really grown in my reviewing of Batman the Animated Series loving is that it's its own Elseworlds lane. It tries to stay very, very, when needed to, it tries to stay very, very true to its comic book source material, but is not afraid to introduce new concepts. And actually, some of the concepts from here bled over into the comics, because like Harley Quinn's a great example of that, mm-hmm. a character who completely is original from Batman the Animated Series that the comics have done their own version of. I would make a strong argument that the comic book version is not identical to the Batman the Animated Series version. They had to alter her to make her work for the comics. This movie, when I watch it, because of the fact that I don't think these are canonical changes to Batman and the Dana Delaney's character of Andrea in this, I don't believe that she is what actually happened in Batman's origin, but she did in this origin. And I really liked the exploration of it. And to Paul's point, now you start having the conversation of, is this what Bruce would do in that situation? And I think that's where this movie gets really fun because of everything that he was bringing up as far as, let's talk about that and how this actually works. So for me, this is an example of really great Elseworlds. And what I love about Elseworlds, and I like the ones, I tend to like the ones that tend to be a little closer to reality, because then you get to really start thinking through some of these concepts. Reality, I'm talking about closer to the comic book continuity, I should say. That's my brand of reality, which tells you a lot about me. But this was something that this time through, and I did not feel this before this viewing, so it's something that stuck. I've got a couple nitpicks about this film of my own. Saying that with the immense love I have for this film, I'll share them a little bit later, but I really enjoy the Elseworlds aspect of this, in my mind.
I'll jump in real fast to say that I completely agree. I mean, as someone who, like I say, is closer to the media version of Batman, mm-hmm. I was 9 when I saw, you know, whoa, the Joker killed Bruce Wayne's parents. Okay. You know, and then like I see a different version and it's Heath Ledger and we don't know where he came from. Okay. You know, like I like it all. Like I visit this for this version. I like this. They're explorations, the Elseworld explorations. And this played like that for me. And I really enjoyed the exploration.
And I'd add that, you know, I don't think that the fact that Bruce was potentially, as depicted in this film, you know, so close to taking the off ramp from his oath, and then, you know, fate intervened again, and he ends up donning the mask. I don't think that weakens his character arc. I think it deepens it because it shows he is ultimately he's a human being, right? And you know that. That scene you mentioned, Paul, where he's at his parents' grave. You know, I've mentioned this to Brian before. That's one of my favorite scenes in any Batman media ever.
Oh, I think it's very powerful.
It's extremely so, you know, and we've never gotten a version of that in live action in that way. And look, ultimately, Batman has had the long-lasting appeal he's had because he is a man. And as such, he would act as a human being would in this circumstance. And so, you know, I question the thesis there, this idea that you know, it somehow weakens his journey or what have you, the idea that he was willing, you know, like he was so willing to walk away. I don't see it that way. I mean, he was staring down the barrel. He knew what the responsibility he had taken on. And he was grappling with that, and that's very rich, you know. I think that this film mines it in a way that certainly the Burton Schumacher movies never did, you know.
Yeah, I would say, you know, Trentus Magnus, who brought up this point, I have tremendous respect for Trentus. He and I have had some great conversations over the years, and I find him to be very, very intelligent, and I value his opinions. And I think his opinion is valid in this instance. But I also think what you're saying is valid. Now, first of all, I would just comment that one of the strengths of Batman is that he works no matter how you try to portray him. You can go from Batman 66 to Batman 89 to Batman the Animated Series to the Nolanverse to the Brave and the Bold cartoon that they had. Mm-hmm. Very, very different versions all around, and they all seem to work in their own way. So that's one of the things that goes to what Sean said about kind of the Elseworlds thing. I myself am often a slave to continuity because I just grew up reading comics and I wanted continuity. I wanted things, you know, what I read 5 years ago, I want to still have that be part of the lore now. I don't want them to just say, well, that doesn't count anymore because it's 5 years old. But I do accept that there are different versions of things. So in this one, they're exploring the fact that, like you said, Zachy, he's human. And any human who's taking on the burden that he took on has to have some sort of doubts and question marks and has to be sent to, I mean, if we go to Christianity, I mean, I don't mean to get this deep, but if we go to Christianity, Jesus is on the cross and saying, Father, why have you deserted me? So he had doubts. So if Jesus had doubts, Bruce Wayne could have doubts.
Case closed.
One thing that I think is interesting, and actually, Paul, I want to piggyback off of something you're saying. First of all, I love that Trentis is sharing his thoughts, and he's not here to be an interactive part of this conversation. So this is not a in any way, shape, or form about pouncing on Trentis or anything. It's just the opposite. I think he's opened up an interesting topic for discussion that we can talk about. One of the things I love about doing this show is the fact that whether we all wind up on the same page at the end as far as what our actual score is of this film, at the end, what's more important is people knowing how we got there. And usually, even if we're all on the same page, how we got there has its own unique flavor to it. So Trentis certainly is an active part of that particular vibe as far as what we do here. So I'm glad he brought that up. One of the things I was thinking about, though, as Zachy was speaking, is how Andrea and Bruce met. So, and also the fact that Bruce was torn throughout. It wasn't like, hey, Batman, bye-bye. It didn't work that way. It was, he was constantly, even with Alfred, it was, should I go forward with this? He was avoiding her at certain points in time, avoiding phone calls, and then going all back into Batman, and then going back to her, and I liked that that wasn't clean. It wasn't this simple break from Batman, but you can see what the attraction would be to her. They're both at the grave sites. He's talking to his parents. She's talking to her parents. There is something there that's kismet, you know, where it's you understand me, I understand you. We've got our own different pieces off of that. Maybe there is another path for me that I hadn't considered. And I love when something opens that doorway for my favorite characters. Like you, Paul, I'm a continuity geek. And why I rationalize this as Elseworlds is for Batman, if I'm like, but continuity's here, this is its own lane, now I can just have fun and enjoy the story that's unfolding before me without feeling like it's got to stick to the comics for me because otherwise I'm going to be really uncomfortable. So then we can have an in-depth conversation about, well, what if you didn't meet her? And what would that look like? And is this Bruce, which I think that's one of the most interesting topics of conversation here, is how Batman does this really feel with these new elements that have been inserted into here? And so much of it that is from comic continuity, that's a part of this as well, because it nails certain things in exactly all the right feels, which is, I think, really interesting.
You know, something I thought about when I was watching The Dark Knight once, there's that moment where Bruce Wayne comes into the restaurant and he has the two women on his arm. And I thought, you know, this is the only scene we really see that. And it just made me wonder, like, what's his Wednesday like? You know, like when there's like a major thing happening, Gotham is, you know, about to be blown up. Like, that's what the movies tend to focus on, the major, major moments that he has to stop. But like, I don't know, does he? Like, go out, even just for appearance's sake. Like, does he go out on dates? Like, what's a night home like? You know, it's from the, you know, his parents dying when he's young to him in his 20s, 30s, whatever. That's a lot of years. And so for me, this is an interesting thing that most live action movies probably wouldn't explore because it's not so major or big or bombastic, you know, for a Christopher Nolan film. But like, yeah, maybe there was a moment where he kind of bonded with this woman and they both kind of had grief in their lives, and there was this fleeting moment where he thought, wow, maybe there is a path to happiness for me, but it didn't work out. And then the live action ones show the bigger moments again. And so I guess that's what I really love about this one. This feels like a more intimate moment that would have been off screen, or maybe, you know, like a passing reference in one of the bigger films, you know.
Well, my first thought is, who wouldn't fall in love with 1993 Dana Delaney? Right? I think that just goes without saying.
And I'll say 2025 Dana Delaney also.
she was just in Tulsa King recently.
Oh.
If you haven't seen, it's kind of funny because it's almost like The Sopranos meets Yellowstone, which is just
interesting. Sounds about right.
There's a Kevin Conroy documentary that's a part of this. I've got the Apple TV version of the Apple iTunes, whatever version of Batman Mask of the Phantasm. And one of the extras is a documentary honoring Kevin Conroy that interviews him from when he was still alive, but also is interviewing the people, including Dana Delaney, who worked with him post when he passed away. And it was really great to see. I didn't even realize she didn't actually have an audition for this. There were like, her name was brought up and it was like, of course we put Dana Delaney in this. And she said, and I thought that was fascinating. I'm like, oh, we just like cited, Dana Delaney, I get that. But with Batman, the animated series and its incredible cast, I guess I would naturally assume that if some of them were like, you know, brought in for a cast, like Mark Hamill and people like that, that were brought in. Was it Tim Curry was also up for the Joker and things like that. If these people were being brought in for these spots, I was shocked to see that they cast her perfect for this, but it was really great to see the love for Kevin Conroy. To your point, Dana Delaney, she is aging incredibly well.
Unlike me.
And me.
I'm always fascinated by people being able to do that, though, because I think we're all trying to stay healthy. And I'm always in awe of people who are able to. I'm like, wow, she looks really good for today.
How she went from older to me and then let me pass her up, I don't know. But somehow she managed that. Now, didn't she also do Lois Lane on some animated?
She was Lois, in Superman the Animated Series.
So, but just going back to the Bruce Wayne thing, because I am fascinated by this aspect of this particular movie, because I've often subscribed to the theory, which I know is pretty popular, that Batman is his real identity and Bruce Wayne is a put on. You know, Bruce Wayne is the show he puts on for people to maintain himself. But Batman is who he really is, as opposed to Superman, where he... You know, he really deep down inside, he's Clark Kent. But in this instance, we're getting a little of this is what Bruce Wayne really is. Because I think most versions just kind of submerge that. You know, he's Bruce Wayne for the sake of being Batman. But now this one is telling us, no, you know what? He actually does have some feelings and he is a real person underneath that mask. And I think that's kind of key to this presentation.
I think there's three people. There is Batman, the show that he puts on for people. There is Bruce Wayne, the show that he puts on for people. And then there's the guy we see with Alfred. There's the guy we see with her when he finally lets her in. I think this is something that I think in the best portrayals of Superman, we get the same thing where we're able to see that a lot of times when we see scenes with him with Ma and Pa Kent and stuff like that, we kind of see the amalgamation of both characters. We see that with Lois. I actually really love when the portrayals have those distinctions, and I feel like this has that. This wasn't meant to dispute you. It was more to like to build off of what you're saying there. I do think that's the piece that's compelling with these characters. It's like as you're they're hard to get to know if you are people that are getting to know them as Bruce the put on and Batman the put on. I think we see him with Jim Gordon at certain times versus when we see him with Jim Gordon and other people there. I think there's two different Batmen that we see there. And I really love when writers and honestly the artists that are portraying the character lean in on that, because I think it's something that's compelling about the different layers of who actually is this guy. And I do think those are the moments where we see the truth as far as who this man is. And it's kind of a blurry line. It's got nothing to do with the costume in or out. Because there's times where he's got the cowl off and he's sitting there with Alfred. That's the real guy.
Now, let me ask you this. How old was Bruce when his parents were killed? Like 10?
Yeah.
So now Alfred becomes his caretaker at that point. Alfred is his guardian. Do you question Alfred for letting him take this path at that point when he sees it coming? Because, I mean, he obviously saw it coming early on, because you can't develop... Even, you know, even in a fantasy world, you can't develop the skill sets that he has without being totally dedicated to it from the beginning. So he was probably obsessed with avenging his parents and preventing this from happening at 10 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old. Does there come a point when the guardian should be saying, you know what, we need to get you to a psychiatrist to get you straightened out? Or does he just enable it, saying, yeah, that area, that giant cave with all the bats in it, that would be an ideal hideout.
I think on his end, you can make the argument that he's an exceptional butler.
I make the argument, and I say that more facetiously than reality, but I make the argument in my mind that he was apparently Alfred was like part of the British underground secret service, whatever, and grew up with, you know, or had a, you know, a moral code that kind of echoed what Bruce's was. So he didn't see a problem with Bruce's obsession because he probably had it himself were he younger.
Well, and you get that nice moment in this film where he sees Bruce with the mask on for the first time and gasps. You know, seeing him, that. You know, succumbing, maybe you could say, you know, finally into the persona, what was inside him all along. Now it's exterior. And he's like, my God.
You
know?
Yeah.
Well, and they make a point of that too. Like the first time he goes into action, he says, you know, I didn't scare them. I needed to have them be afraid of me. And they showed what a difference it would make.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with, I guess, you know, I was going to say, try and point out who said it, but I think we've all said it, that this was, you know, this was a pretty smart script. Mm-hmm. It's well put together. And when you factor in the fact that they were planning this as being a direct-to-video release, and then they decided to make it into a theatrical release, and they changed things about it, including the aspect ratio, but they also changed, at least as I understand it, some of the scripting, so it had all the potential to be a colossal failure. But, you know, like some other things we've talked about, I remember us talking about The Fugitive and how they put it together and how it probably shouldn't have worked, and it worked so, so well. And I think, you know, that might be the case of what we're dealing with here a little bit.
It's a real testament. I mean, if this was just supposed to be, maybe three episodes, spread out over 3 days, and then you stick them together and you get this incredible movie. Real testament to that show.
Well, I want to say one thing about the Alfred piece before we move on, because I was being a little silly, but I have an answer to that, at least my thoughts on it. I think one of the catch-22s that Alfred's in is you've got two choices there. Do I either stay here and support him and hope he works through this in the healthiest possible way, or do I walk away, and what does he become? And I feel like that's the catch-22 of Alfred and the responsibility that Alfred has in all of this, because Bruce is going ahead no matter what.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I actually love that aspect of the story. I think it's great that you're bringing it up, because I think it applies to this film, because I think we see a portrayal of Alfred here where Alfred's trying to support potential other options in his life, but he's not abandoning him when Batman becomes a thing. And the duality of what's going on in this piece, he's trying to skirt a line of being there for this guardian. You know, he's a guardian of this this child who has grown into this man, but he's a friend, a mentor, more than anything else. And I actually love that complexity of the character of Alfred when it's portrayed like it was here, because those moments where you see that glimmer of, he could find happiness. And I think it's something in Batman films, whether they're live action or they're animated like this, when you're able to capture some of these moments where there's a glimmer of hope for Bruce to have some form of normal, I love that Alfred tries to encourage it without going too far and pushing Bruce away from that chance. And I think this was a film that I think keyed in on that piece. So I'm glad we're talking about Alfred, because I think that was well played in this. And I really enjoyed that aspect of this film.
I think the right way for me to look at this, at least, and I compare it a little bit to The Dark Knight Rises, which we will eventually get to talking about. But at the end of The Dark Knight Rises, he's retired and living the casual life. I don't see Bruce Wayne ever doing that. I see him yearning for that his entire life, but I don't see him ever achieving it, because while he may feel like he's finally set Gotham up, again, like he says here, he could donate money to the police, feel like he's got crime under control or whatever, at some point there's going to be an emergency that's going to force him to say, I have to get back into action because I feel a responsibility to this. And I think, the next thing we're going to do is Batman Beyond. And I think that is more true to the way Bruce Wayne will be, as he gets older. He may not be able to be out there and doing the same thing, but I don't see Bruce Wayne, when his life comes to an end, I don't see him having a comfortable death.
That is this universe too.
Yeah, it is the same universe. Yes.
So you know, that makes me think. Oh, sorry.
No.
Picturing that ending from The Dark Knight Rises, which I do, it makes me feel good. But then, yes, I think about next week when he reads the paper and sees that something crazy is going down in Gotham. Like, it's hard for me to imagine him staying in Italy or whatever. But you know, it'd be kind of a nice, like, fan edit to the end of The Dark Knight Rises is seeing that ending and Alfred looking at him and Selina together. And, you know, he raises his glass or he gives it a little nod or whatever it is that Bruce does to Alfred. And then all of a sudden we cut to that scene from Batman Returns where Michael Keaton is sitting there lost in thought in his chair in that dark room. And then the signal flashes and he looks up and stands up. Like, that's what he fantasizes. Could that be an ending for me someday? But then the signal flashes, not tonight.
It's one of the things, I mean, you know, a lot of people rag on the Flash movie that came out last year. But in that, Batman is destined to go out in a blaze of glory, you know, and I don't disagree with that. And I liked that movie a lot more than the general populace did. But
same.
Zachy and I too, yeah.
I find that that's a common occurrence. That same thing happened with me with Man of Steel, which I enjoyed and everybody told me I shouldn't.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. I'm amen.
Who we got there?
Yeah.
Sorry, that's my daughter.
Well, tell her we all said that.
She's like, what about Batgirl?
What about Batgirl?
We need more Batgirl. I think that's her takeaway.
I can't disagree with her.
She's like, why isn't Warner Brothers releasing Batgirl featuring Michael Keaton as Batman? She's very upset about that.
You're raising these kids right, Zachy. That's all I could say.
Like, there is Cindy a Batgirl movie I want to see. Even though they mothballed it, I still want to see it.
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely.
So what a cast they have in this movie. Let's, you know, we've mentioned Kevin Conroy, and you know, to a lot of people, Kevin Conroy is the Batman actor, even though he's a voice actor. But you know, it took me a while to connect Kevin Conroy, the voice actor, with an image of him until I saw he was on an episode of Cheers.
Yep.
And that's how I said, oh, that's what Kevin Conroy looks like, you know?
He's a baseball player, right?
Yes. Yeah, he's like I think he was a former teammate of Sam's or something like that. But, like, he could, I mean, from the looks of him back then, he could have played Batman. So I could see it. So, he's definitely one of the best Batman people, the same way Mark Hamill is possibly the best version of the Joker we've had in any type of live action, but any type of moving picture, because he really hits it kind of the way the comic books do, which Jack Nicholson's different from in the comic books, and Heath Ledger is different from in the comic books, and I can't even think of Jared Leto couldn't be more different from what we see in the comic books.
Brian's favorite Joker.
Hold me back.
No, I don't recall you discussing that one. Did you hate that one tremendously, or did you like it?
Not a fan. Not a fan.
Brian has thoughts.
Okay. Because I was not a fan of that either. But you know, even you know, I don't think we've seen any version of the Joker that's closer to the comic books than this one.
I would agree.
And there was an episode of the series, and I know I'm just kind of rambling now, but there was an episode of the series where I think there was like a petty crook out there who thought the Joker had it out for him. Yes. And every time he turned around, the Joker was kind of there and he was afraid. Mm-hmm. And that felt like, you know, I mean, it was still Mark Hamill doing it, and it that felt like the Joker from the comics. I always wondered if that was adapted from an issue of the comic series.
It's not even a petty crook. It's a guy who... he cuts off the Joker.
Right. Oh, I remember this now. Yeah.
And so he's like, I just flipped off the Joker, basically. And then it ends up in twirling his entire life, you know?
Yeah. And I always wondered if there was an issue of Detective Comics or Batman that had that actual story in it that made them decide to adapt that one. Cause it just seems so, it's like such a classic Silver Age kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
Just getting back to the cast here, we mentioned Dana Delaney, Hart Bochner, is it pronounced, as the bad guy in hiding, Arthur Reeves. Stacy Keach, who I love, was the voice of the Phantasm as well as her father. Mm-hmm. And then we have Abe Vigoda.
I love Abe Vigoda.
playing Sal Tessio, I mean Valestra.
Fish.
And Fish.
And I mean, Dick Miller's great in everything. Ephraim Zemlis Jr. as Alfred. I mean, this is a star-studded cast for a movie that was meant for direct-to-DVD. Yeah. They even managed to squeeze Mary Lou Henner in. So I just think this cast is phenomenal.
Yeah. But this is an example of what the animated series did well, too. Mm-hmm. You're talking about, because remember, at this point in time, the animated series has been established. And they were using that level of cast quality for the animated series. So when it shifted to the film, they just brought in additional, you know, cast for the scope and scale of this film. And it is a great who's who of talent. It just showed how they viewed the quality of what they wanted from this production. And I think you're right, DePaul, to point out the level of cast that we've got here, because these are some terrific players in this that really, I think, deliver.
Well, the casting, I assume, for this is the same as the TV series, that it was Andrea Romano. And, I mean, she's famous for having done so many good voice castings between this and the Justice League cartoons. Clearly she has a skill set. Let's just put it that way.
Dana Delaney had a line, and I'm sorry, guy, I did this one. I think it's pivotal to this piece. When she was talking about her first day on the set, she was talking about how serious everyone, and she goes, oh my gosh, this is serious. This isn't a cartoon. And I just loved that distinction between at least what her thought was of a cartoon versus an animated feature. Mm-hmm. And what she learned in being a part of this whole piece. It was an interesting, just quick little line, but it was one of her first impressions from the first day on the set as far as what this actually was. And you can see how this cast viewed this. And I think it's one of the reasons why we're talking about it on this level.
Yeah, well, going back to Zachy brought up the Siskel and Ebert review. I watched that also. And it's interesting seeing Ebert like come to animation's defense in the review, saying like, I think, you know, older audiences are going to realize that there's a whole arena of, you know, you can tell stories in a whole different way. The possibilities in animation, you know, don't have to be limited to children's stories. And this movie proves that and thinks that there are big things ahead for adult stories in animation. And it's just funny to think that, I mean, now I think that's every new cartoon I see feels like it's made for adults now. Right. You know, they're sort of like adult themes or whatever, you know, Rick and Morty, you know, stuff. And it's just funny. This was a moment. Yeah, I can imagine Dana Delaney coming in being like, you know, what is this, like Return of Jafar? Let's go. You know. But now you can imagine people would have more of an understanding of maybe what they're walking into, how seriously these stories are taken as well, just because, you know, even though they're animated.
Well, I think we talked about with one of the previous Batman movies about the difference between making something for kids, making something for adults, making something all ages. And there's sometimes it gets lost that people think, oh, cartoons are for kids. Mm-hmm. But if they're done right, they're for all ages. And I think people learned that that's the case once like Pixar became big. Mm-hmm. Because they did so many things that were meant, you know, that people took their kids to see them because they were what they were, and then realized, hey, you know what, this is entertaining for me as well. And I think, you know, they realized that all ages is a thing. I think that had escaped a lot of people. And I think, just not to go too far off on the Pixar thing, but I think that was borne out in some of their early films when they would have the blooper reel at the end. And you know, that was something that the parents, you know, the kids would laugh at just because it was silly, but the parents would laugh at because it's so based on, you know, the blooper reels we've seen of live action things. And it's hilarious when you're watching that. So this definitely has the feel of all ages. In fact, it might not even totally be all ages, because I think under the age of 8, I don't think a kid could really appreciate this that much. Mm. because there are some dark themes going through this one, and there's some scenes that I think could scare a very young child.
Sure. Sure. And, you know, there was a moment where I don't remember what the scene was, but it was a bunch of adults standing around in a room talking. And I was thinking, like, how would, like, an 8-year-old, if they're like, I want to watch a Batman movie, and they're watching this, and because it's animated, thinking it's going to appeal to them on a certain sort of level. But yeah, it does have kind of adult themes and love lost and sorts of things that I think we might relate to a little bit more. Not that a kid couldn't enjoy it, but.
But I think a kid can enjoy it, because I do think, you know, you get some Batman action in there and you get the Phantasm action, and you know, there's enough stuff going on that I think a child can enjoy this. But there's also the things that I think would go over a child's head, like the scene we're talking about at the grave of his parents, when he's agonizing over the fact that he doesn't want to live this life that he feels fated to live, that he wants to be happy, you know, and that before this, he just thought he couldn't be happy. And now that he knows he can, it's something he'd like to pursue. I mean, I think an adult can relate to that. I think an adult, you know, we don't have Batman's level of dedication to stamping out crime, but I think any adult who lives a life that they should lead at some point feels the weight of responsibility and realizes, you know, wow, when I was young, I could just live my life and not care about, you know, paying the bills or going to work or, you know, doing all these things, taking care of my partner or whatever, you know, but then you have to go on and you have to grow up. And so, you know, I think you could all relate to it. So I think it's again, an incredibly powerful scene.
Yeah.
What'd you think of the animation? What was the thought process there?
I think sometimes we see a couple points. I think that we see the limitations inherent in Warner Brothers trying to plus this up from something that was straight to video to something that was theatrical. And for as effective as the show was on the small screen, I think you know, it the animation style they developed was for speed, you know, so that they could produce the show efficiently on that model. And I think some of those scenes show. And then the other thought is, you know, during the life of the series, you know, Bruce Timm and Paul Dini, and as they were figuring out how to streamline their designs further, you know, after Batman the Animated Series, it became the new Batman Adventures on the WB, and they redesigned the characters so that they were even more stark, and that just animated better. And so I feel like this movie emerged at a moment where, unfortunately, it doesn't highlight to me what the animation was able to do at its best on the small screen, and what you end up seeing is a theatrical movie that can't measure up to, you know, Disney animation or something, because it just didn't have the long production window to allow for that.
Building off of something that you're saying there, I feel like too, there's certain sequences where it's very clear this film versus even the animated series episodes was trying to incorporate some digital effects. You know, you see it with what they're doing with the cityscape of Gotham and stuff. That's like right. That. I've got to say, in 93 versus now, I remember being in awe of that in the theater, because we're seeing this on a big screen with this big sound. That was very cool. It felt like they were doing something bigger. It's much more noticeable now when you see it in comparison to how far along that has moved, where other things don't feel as dated in that way for me. That was something, and I love this film, but that was something, it did stand out in this when they were trying to incorporate digital effects, because of the fact that they were almost jarring at times with what they were doing. I applaud them for doing it though, because what they were trying to do, and it is early days, so if you're a fan of like them moving that forward, I think it was their attempt to, like, how do we make Gotham feel bigger? How do we make this feel more epic? So that's what they were doing here, but it did, boy, did it stand out in this. I, you know, as I was going through, I'm like, oh, they're trying to put in some digital effects here. Very good on you for the attempt, but boy, does it stand out.
I think, you know, sometimes, and we've talked about this in the past as well, that sometimes you have to look at the era that movies are made in to kind of get a feel for, you know, what they were capable of doing, what they weren't capable of doing. And if you look at animation – And I think I'm thinking back to like when I was very young, when I was taken to the movies to see The Jungle Book or The Aristocats. And if you look at that Disney animation in those movies, now that is, those are about 20 years before this, so it's not like it's contemporaneous. But if you look at that animation, a lot of times the line work gets a little sloppy in it, where you know you could actually kind of see where it's drawn, and it's not, you know, it's not a clean line image. And then it developed and it got better over time, to the point when Disney kind of had its resurgence with The Little Mermaid and Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast, where the animation became more elaborate. And I think they had made much more use of computer generated scenes and things. But there's a progression there. And this was a TV production that got upgraded to a movie production. And the TV animation lagged behind the film versions to a great extent. So, like I said, while I'm pointing to the film versions from the 60s and 70s, I think that's where television animation might have reached in the 80s and 90s, which is where this is. So I think if you view this as what it was, effectively, that it was a TV movie, you know, direct-to-video that they decided to release on the big screen, I think you forgive some of the animation weaknesses. You know, and that forgiveness comes just from an understanding of, you know, where they were technology wise and budget wise and that type of thing. You know, if they had known, if this had gotten a big screen budget from day one and it had been planned for the big screen, I think you would have seen more dynamic animation and more clean images.
Yeah. I mean, even Bruce Timm has said he cringes when he sees it, and then, but it's because he has all the context. He knew that they were under the gun, that this was a last minute thing. He tells a story about, you know, they had already handed out all the storyboards for what they're going to do, thinking this was going to be a television effort, when Warner Brothers was like, no, this is going on the big screen, and they had to rethink very quickly. But I think everything we've just said just goes to show how strong this story is, that we're willing to forgive hitches in the animation because we love the story we're experiencing so much. I mean, again, going back to the Siskel and Ebert thing, they didn't even comment on the animation, really. They were just talking about what a beautiful story it was. And it is, you know?
Yeah.
Well, so you can forgive those things. And especially, it's nice to know the context, because you're like, oh, well, that makes sense. But, you know, it's one of the, you don't think of that first when you're talking about this film.
I agree. And it's, you know, we could sit here and we can criticize the animation, but it's not that it's bad. It's really just that, you know, we have grown to expect something a little bit, just a little bit more for the big screen, I think. Mm-hmm. Especially now, and I've talked about this in the past too, that, you know, back when this came out, I would say the average home probably had a 25 or 27 inch TV set in the living room. Now the, you know, the average home has a 50 inch TV set, and some have 75, and my brother has a 98 inch TV set now, which I keep saying to my wife, we have to get one of those. but I can't justify getting rid of our 75 inch to get it, because, you know, it still works fine. So, you know, when you put it on the biggest screen, I think the flaws do stand out more, but I think that's true for anything, especially when you start talking high definition. It's amazing sometimes, and I hate that this happens, but it's amazing sometimes on high definition on a big screen, you start seeing like flaws to people's complexion and things like that. Yeah. And it's like, I don't even want to see this. You know, I'd rather it be just slightly blurred and I don't see that.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Or makeup. Makeup.
Or the makeup. Yes.
Yes. Sometimes, under eye makeup. And
yes. Stuff that they're doing deliberately because of the fact that that was just what film was like at that time. There's certain things that stand out where it's like, there's a layer that you see that you never saw before.
Yeah.
And I'm usually willing to forgive those things. Things I can just, you know, go right by them. And you know, I know with my wife, we have healthy debates sometimes with some older TV shows. And when you put an older TV show that has not been upgraded for high definition on a big screen, high definition TV set, it looks blurry. Mm. And that just bothers her and she can't get by it. She's like, I just can't look at this. Mm-hmm. Whereas I can just kind of say, yeah, it is what it is.
Sure. You know? Sure.
But you know, I think it that's up to the, you know, the eyes of the individual and how you can do things. But again, I don't think there's anything so bad in the animation here that it prevents you from enjoying it. I don't think my wife would say, "Oh, this, I can't look at this." It's, you know, because of the line work or whatever. So
yeah, if they had more time and more money, maybe they would have had a few extra frames. You know,
I would imagine
smoothing out. Yeah, but
can I mention a minor gripe that I have?
Yeah, you said you had a couple of gripes, and I was going to ask you to clarify them.
Okay, so when she and the Joker, and it's because of the fact that this is so connected with the larger Batman the Animated Series, I'm not sure after this film how the Joker doesn't know he's Bruce Wayne.
Hmm.
There is a sequence where Phantasm's been revealed and all of that, and she keeps referring to Batman as darling. How does he not know? Because he is supposed to be the mob killer from before, which I love that. I actually loved all of it.
Yeah.
This is minor, by the way. I want to be very clear. I love this film. These are minor things. This time around, I was like sitting, I'm like, wait a minute. How doesn't he just not know at this point that, like, hey, you're Batman, Bruce Wayne, same guy. Just because the whole darling piece, she's dropping it around like it, everything's darling this, darling that. And I get it. The Joker, I feel firmly, my view on the Joker is he is crazy brilliant.
Exactly.
He's absolutely insane, but he's crazy brilliant. And it's something I think that gets lost sometimes in the exterior show that he puts on. But I think one of the reasons why the Joker is such a survivor is he's crazy, yes, but there is a certain level of brilliance in his insanity that is there. And I think this show is an example of something that has portrayed that. I think this film portrays it to it at various points in time. And I love that. Again, very minor little thing over that, but it comes from the fact that when you're watching it so intently, you notice different things the next time through when you watch it. So that was one of them.
I kind of go with the thought process that the Joker does not live in the moment. So he, something like that might just escape his notice because he's not focused on that. He's focused on the gag and the creating bedlam and what he can do. So something like that might escape him. Whereas, like you say, he's crazy brilliant. He's scheming different things and coming up with different ways to do things and how he's going to deal with it if this gets counteracted or whatever. So there's a brilliance there, but I don't think he's sitting there listening and saying, well, she said this. You know what I mean? I that's just the way I view him.
I always like the comics portrayal of the idea too that he doesn't want the game dead.
Yes. Mm. Oh, I absolutely, you know, agree. So with
which,
that.
Which is a justification for, like, well, why wouldn't he just use that? Because the game would be over. And if that gets out, there's a certain humor to him knowing and being able to play around with it, which I wasn't where I was going. Actually, I'm kind of justifying for myself certain things that I liked. The other little piece that got me on this one, it's more of a question that I have more than anything else. So the police are hunting him. And I actually loved that Batman was outside of Gordon's window and did not go to the bat signal because he knew they were hunting him. Hmm. Why at the end of the film is he going to the bat signal? I understand that he and Gordon are way cool, but where in the story was it automatically justified that I know that the police were chasing him, but even when they were chasing Phantasm vanished and they saw Batman. When did the police know that Phantasm wasn't Batman in this? I'm asking the question, not immediately going to, this is my exclamation point.
I don't have it in front of me, but I did go on IMDb trivia. Mm-hmm. And there was a deleted scene where some photographer had some sort of evidence, but it was not included. So to your point, I mean, he is cleared. He does have his name cleared and there is some sort of photographic evidence that helps, but
it didn't ruin it for me. I'm just asking because I thought it was.
Oh, well, I can read it to you, actually. I just found it.
I wonder why they would delete it, only because this was so short to begin with. You would think, you know, unless it was something that they thought was bad, you would think you'd leave it in.
Yeah, this is per IMDb trivia, so take this with a grain of salt. But it says the film does not explain how Batman's name was cleared, but the novelization reveals a subplot about a man named Burton Ernie. That's wow, that's hilarious. I hadn't read it out loud this morning. An amateur photographer living in Gotham who managed to take a photograph of the Phantasm and prove Batman was not the one killing the gangsters. Burton is actually in the film. He is the man who meets Andrea on the boat at the end of the film using the reward money he got from his exonerating photo to go on a cruise.
So they never actually animated that.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe that
was in the novelization.
Novelization. Filling in a gap, maybe, that someone was like, hey, wait a minute.
But they should have filmed that. Yeah. Again, well, but then again, the novelization may have been written after the film was completed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was very common back. I mean, I think this was obviously, I think the novelization would have come after the fact because this was meant to be an animated series all along. Right. Again, these are minor things, so I wasn't like sitting here like saying, oh my gosh, now I hate the film. It wasn't that at all. Mm-hmm. There were just two things that I noticed this time around that I'm kind of like, wait a minute, why would he do, like, why all of a sudden is he like, oh, hey, Phantasm thing's all done now. Let me go swing to that bat signal because that was going to work out so well last time. I found that fascinating.
All right.
Should have just been him swinging over and being like, oh, wait. And then, you know, the iris in.
Okay. Any other things on this before we close it out?
I really enjoyed revisiting this, and I'm glad that we're shining a light on it, because I think some people may not even know it exists, or if they've seen it on HBO Max, they might think, oh, well, I'm here for the tiles where I know, oh, there's Val Kilmer, there's Christopher Nolan, or, you know, whatever, Christian Bale. And I think people who enjoy all of the live action Batman films will love this one almost as much, if not as much. And so
I tend to agree with you. And that's where it left me with the question of, do I rate this as Jaws or Jaws 2? Because I can't see any world where I would rate this as a Jaws 3. So it's the question is, does it reach the level of Jaws? And on some part of me, I'm saying not quite. But when I break it down, I don't really have a good, solid reason to say it's not. I think it's immensely enjoyable. The characterizations are deep and, you know, just really resonate. The voice acting is just about incomparable. And the only level where I feel like this could have been better is, well, the only two levels is, I kind of wish it had been a little longer and they had fleshed out a little bit more. And the animation could have been more geared towards the big screen. But I don't think either of those presents a flaw that takes it out of Jaws. So I'm going to say this is on the lower end of Jaws, but it's Jaws.
Who's next?
I'll go.
I agree.
Oh. There you go. Oh. Yeah. Sean?
No, I did. He said I agree. Do you want to?
Oh, no, I agreed with it. Zachy. Zachy said.
I was agreeing with Brandon.
Okay. So I'll go next. Thinking through where this was at, I really struggled. To me, Batman the Animated Series is Jaws. And if you're listening to this and you've never engaged with Batman the Animated Series, this is a perfectly good starting point. I love the animated series, and so many of the episodes are Jaws to me. So when I'm having trouble, like, sitting here saying, do I feel this is equal with some of those? I don't. What I do feel is this is an absolutely high Jaws 2. This is me personally, by the way. I for anybody that, Paul, so you saying where it was, I was like sitting here, I'm like, I don't disagree with them, but I kind of have my own thoughts on it. I think this film, I loved everything about it. I think for somebody, if you've never experienced DC Elseworlds, I think this is absolutely a great starting point for that. This is I think it's a must-see movie. It's a very high Jaws 2 for me. The animated series, I've got so many favorite episodes that I think are Jaws, and I think are representative of what I consider to be that category, that's what's doing it. As far as if I were just comparing it with straight Batman films, and we got to go on that end, I might be more inclined to go that route with it, but I'm going to stick with my guns on this one just because my experience is really based on the animated series. So please, if you're throwing things at this, I don't know, if you look at Batman the Animated Series, I feel like there's episodes of Batman the Animated Series are more in the upper tier, and I feel like this is just slightly below some of those, and that gives it the high Jaws 2 rating. I do think it's a must-see.
I absolutely understand that. I think for me, I'm kind of with Paul. I realize that I think it's amazing. As I was reading about the production and what they set out to do, the ambition where they said, let's not go to the regular rogues gallery. Let's tell a romance story. Let's try something a little bit different. And I really admire that swing. I really admire that. I think they succeed in telling me a story where I could, me speaking for myself, believe that Bruce, you know, who's like kind of hard and fast on his mission of vengeance, could have a moment where he does glimpse a little bit of light and wonders what that would be like. And I just love that so much. And I feel like this is executed well enough where I believe, you know, that questioning from him. And I also feel like I've gone on a whole fully realized journey by the end of it with where he winds up. But I, you know, you do have to excuse maybe a little bit of this, a little bit of that along the way. So I'll go with the sort of, you said like the lower end of Jaws, like I'll go with the TV edit of Jaws on this. because yeah, there's a couple chinks in the armor, but like I just think it's a really ambitious swing, and I really admire it and really enjoy it.
Yeah, I think I like what Brian said, TV edit of Jaws. I think Sean's point is very well stated that, yeah, I if you were to compare it with episodes of this show, there are better episodes. I think if we're looking at where it stacks amongst the live action Batman films, especially of that era, then it's unquestionably a Jaws for me.
Okay. I'm trying to remember now. I did an entire watch through of the animated series at one point, and I seem to remember Over the Edge being the most popular episode, which is kind of a Batman Elseworlds fantasy nightmare episode.
That's the dream sequence one, right? Where he...
Yes. He's like drugged and he has like a dream sequence.
That's a good one. Yeah.
I seem to remember that as being the one that people pointed to as the best episode. So if somebody's never experienced Batman the Animated Series, I would say see this movie first and then go to that series. And if you're not willing to start from Christmas with the Joker and work your way through, go, you know, look for the top episodes, and that would be one of them. Also, if you've already listened to this entire episode, because I can't send you away from us, but once you've listened to this whole episode, if you want to seek out Zachy's commentary from Nostalgia Theater, I remember listening to that a while back and thinking it was excellent. So
thank you.
I think you should. And just as an aside, because they know I feel this way, I think Zachy and Brian's commentaries are top notch all around, because they, if nothing else, they give you a presentation of the movie where if you have the movie running in the background, that's great. But if you don't feel lost, and it's just brings you right through with the excellent conversations that they have. Yeah, so awesome. I recommend those to everybody. The only problem is that I'm not willing to pay the Patreon money because I'm a cheap son of a bitch. So I have to get commercials during it now.
Oh man. Yeah.
But that said, I want to thank you guys for coming on. This is always fun, and I always appreciate it. And next time out, we're going to do Batman Beyond: The Return of the Joker.
Nice.
Which I'm looking forward to.
Sounds great. I always love coming back here and chatting with you guys. This is a blast.
So, thank you again, guys. And I mentioned Nostalgia Theater. There's also the Movie Film Podcast. If you're not familiar with that, it's an excellent movie show. Almost at the level of Is It Jaws?
We'll get there one day, I'm hoping.
Yeah, it's at a Jaws 2 at the moment, but we're working on it.
So thank you guys, and thank you everybody for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
That's a scene from Batman Mask of the Phantasm, a Batman animated feature that was made in 1993, and Roger and I never reviewed it. And as far as I'm concerned, we made a big mistake, because it's terrific. I enjoyed it more than the current Batman adventure that's in theaters, and I kind of like that picture. This film, however, is really smart and beautifully drawn and intricately plotted, obviously, Batman lends himself to animation, and just take a look at the Art Deco-influenced drawing style, the classic cartoon drawing style, as we find Batman caught up in a web of love and violence and guilt. Somebody dressed in a bat cape is killing mobsters. It's not Batman, but his name is now being sullied as a killer.
I'm telling you, friends, it's vigilantism at its deadliest. How many times are we gonna let Batman cross the line?
I'm sorry, Councilman, but you can't blame Batman for what happened to Chucky Shaw.
Why not? He's a loose cannon, Commissioner.
There's more, including the Joker, who frankly was better when Jack Nicholson played him in the first movie, or Cesar Romero in the cartoon show on TV. I don't like this Joker's voice.
You're too late, Batman! There are 20 miles of tunnels under this place, and they're all filled with high explosives. In 5 minutes, everything goes up!
But it's the drawing style that really distinguishes Batman Mask of the Phantasm. You can really lose yourself in all of these great images as Batman fights against the Phantasm, his deadly imitator. If I were forced to rank all of the Batman movies made in the last few years, I'd rank this one, this animated one, just under the first live-action Batman from Tim Burton. I wish Warner Brothers would produce more animated features from this same production team. I'm sorry we caught up with this picture a couple years late, but it's available on tape and disc. I watch it at home on Laserdisc, and with a booming surround sound system, Batman Mask of the Phantasm was big time entertainment. I really liked it.
You know, I think that the day is coming, and it's also happening with the Disney pictures, when adults are realizing that animation is not limited to an right. entertainment form for children. Right. And that animation can do some things live action can't do. For example, the sets of the city in this movie are seen more clearly than they are in the live action
Absolutely
movies, where they get kind of murky.
Right.
The exaggeration of the effects and of the camera angles can be stretched, and perspective can be played with in a way that isn't available in the real world. And then also here, it's interesting that they really did have a story, more
they
of a
really
story
do.
Than the movies. And
yes.
the characters, and they pause,
They're
and they
motivated.
Think, and they have feelings and motivations, and you get involved in it.
I got completely involved in it, mm-hmm. and also, it's tight. It's 77 minutes long, every image counts. Remember, mm-hmm. they're spending more money in animation, mm-hmm. maybe per minute, than they are in some live-action pictures, and they're very economically done.
So you saw Batman Forever and you still want to see some Batman? Try renting this, right?
You got
Coming
it.
Up next.